Before we get going with this episode, and we'll get to it in less than a minute, let's quickly take care of some important business. As you probably know, this podcast is produced by a public radio station. And of course, it wouldn't be public radio if we didn't have a pledge drive. So here it is. Maybe you listen to the Modern West for a deeper connection to the place you live. Or maybe it's to stay connected with your former home. Whatever your reason for listening, right now it would mean a lot if you'd make a donation, in any amount, to help pay for producing the Modern West. There's a donate link at our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org, and you can make a quick and secure donation there. Again, any amount helps, and the more people who give, the further the dollars go. So please be one of the listeners who makes the show possible. Thanks for pitching in. And now, on to the show.
The manager said to her, you know, he has this picture of a guy on his phone, and if you, as a woman, had this picture on your phone, it would have been okay, but Josh is a guy. That's just, we can't have that.
From Wyoming Public Media, this is The Modern West. I'm Micah Schweitzer. You've seen it on quarters, signs, on the state seal, and on the state flag. Wyoming prides itself on being the equality state, since it became the first state to grant women the right to vote in 1869. But for the state's LGBT community, Wyoming may not be living up to its motto. But first, let's go back to October of 2014. That's when Wyoming County clerks began issuing marriage licenses to same-sex couples for the first time in the state's history. Wyoming Public Radio's Miles Bryan was at the Albany County Courthouse for that historic milestone, while Wyoming Public Radio's Aaron Schrank was at the Laramie County Courthouse.
The Albany County Courthouse is normally a pretty sleepy place, but this morning is different. Wyoming's Attorney General will soon file notice the state won't appeal the court ruling that threw out Wyoming's gay marriage ban. After that, same-sex couples can start getting their marriage licenses. County Clerk Jackie Gonzalez addresses the growing crowd of bystanders a few minutes before 10 a.m.
I appreciate everybody's patience. We are currently awaiting the approval of the order to come in via email.
While there are over a dozen well-wishers, there's only one couple actually waiting to get hitched, Teresa Bingham and Linda Mahaffey. They have to remind everyone that they're just getting their marriage license. Their wedding is set for this summer.
Super excited.
Yeah, ready to get the day here now. Uh-huh. But just this summer, July, we'll get married.
At 10:05, Clerk Gonzalez comes out to give the couple some forms to fill out. Even she starts choking up.
Pardon me. I'm kind of out of breath here.
Ann Guzzo is one of those here to cheer Teresa and Linda on. She and her partner were plaintiffs in the case that got Wyoming's ban on same-sex marriage overturned.
It's really exciting. This has been the best part of it for me, is watching the results of this and watching people finally be able to get married.
At a quarter past, Teresa and Linda finally head back into the clerk's office. With photographers and spectators surrounding them, it doesn't feel totally routine, but it went off without a hitch. A county official even ribbed Teresa about being from out of state.
A Colorado girl?
No. But I came and I stayed.
Finally, 45 minutes, a few forms, and $30 later, Teresa Bingham and Linda Mahaffey had their marriage license. For Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Miles Bryan in Laramie.
Here at the Laramie County Courthouse in Cheyenne, it's just before 10 a.m., and Jennifer Muma is ready to become one of the first people in the state to get married since Wyoming's same-sex marriage ban was overturned.
Right now, I'm just sitting here anxiously at the courthouse outside the marriage license office, waiting for my partner to show up. So now we're hoping to actually get the license and get married down here this morning.
Muma's soon-to-be spouse, A.J. McDaniel, walks in minutes later, and the pair get their paperwork in order. McDaniel is a transgender man, but legally female, which means the pair couldn't get married in the state until today. McDaniel says they had a family ceremony last week, but today, it's official.
It represents the legal side, the fact that our relationship is going to be finally recognized.
Just behind them in the matrimony line are Cheyenne couple Tina Johnson and Stacy Maloney.
I'm super excited. Been looking forward to this day for a long time. It'll be just nice to have it legal, I guess.
And I'm nervous, even though we've been together as long as we have.
The couple has been together 14 years and has two children. Their son, Cody Johnson, skipped school today to come to the courthouse.
I'm here to support my parents.
While Cody's family finishes up their paperwork, the Reverend Audette Fulbright officiates a brief, windy wedding ceremony for McDaniel and Muma just outside the courthouse doors.
The joining of two hearts and two lives in the state of matrimony is a sacred act.
This is a big day for Fulbright, too. She's a longtime gay marriage advocate.
I've been a Unitarian Universalist minister for over 17 years, and this is an issue that you have been working on for such a long time. And, you know, state by state, you're on tenterhooks all the time, and then suddenly things really begin to shift. So this is so exciting.
Grave, love mightily. Amen. You may seal this union with a kiss.
McDaniel and Muma seal their new marriage with a kiss, and their ceremony is followed by another for Johnson and Maloney just minutes later. These are among the very first Wyoming same-sex couples to not only get their marriage licenses, but to actually get married. When all is said and done, McDaniel wears an ear-to-ear smile.
I'm feeling great. This is a great feeling.
For McDaniel, getting legally married is also a step towards something even more important to him, getting legal custody of he and Muma's four-month-old son. For Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Aaron Schrank in Cheyenne.
Although same-sex couples now have access to all the legal rights that come with marriage, some disparities remain. For one, Wyoming lacks any legal protection for LGBT people at their jobs. So while same-sex couples in the Equality State can legally marry, employers can also legally fire them. Miles Bryan has that story.
The party at the Albany County Courthouse started at 10:45 a.m. last Tuesday. That's when Laramie's first same-sex marriage license was issued, with a dozen well-wishers cheering the happy couple on. Meg Thompson was one of those supporters. She got married to her partner, Emily, last year in Washington, D.C., and they had their ceremony in the Snowy Mountains last July.
Old-timers of Wyoming say, if summer comes on a weekend, we should have a barbecue. And that was actually the weekend it came.
Thompson says she's thrilled her marriage is finally recognized here in her home state, but she's careful about who she shares that with. She does contract work as a carpenter and as a basketball coach.
You know, even me, who's had mostly positive experiences in life with being out, I still have to think about it.
Wyoming is one of 11 states that has same-sex marriage but doesn't have employment protection for gay people. They include Pennsylvania, Virginia, Indiana, and Oklahoma, where the Supreme Court recently allowed same-sex marriage to go forward. Laramie State Representative Kathy Connolly says discrimination against LGBT people in the workplace isn't just the obvious stuff, like being fired.
It can be not being invited to X, Y, and Z, where everyone knows that being invited there with your partner or spouse is the way that there's camaraderie that's built, that a boss feels comfortable promoting someone.
Wyoming's Fair Standards Office, which deals with workplace discrimination, says it gets about 10 formal complaints from LGBT people every year, and many more informal inquiries. Representative Connolly has proposed anti-discrimination legislation every year for the last six sessions. Every year it doesn't pass.
Every year it gets closer, and that's the way that I prefer to think about it.
There are national efforts as well. Stacey Simmons is with the LGBTQ Task Force, a nationwide advocacy group. She's working to get federal laws passed that would ban discrimination against gays in employment, but also in other areas like housing.
We don't have consistent protections across the board, which is why we're working so hard.
Last year, the Senate passed the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, or ENDA, but it stalled in the House. Even in today's political climate, that's surprising. The polling company Gallup stopped asking Americans if they were in favor of anti-discrimination laws back in 2008, after the approval rating hit 89%. Simmons says getting same-sex marriage is great, but it's not enough.
I mean, it's a lovely story, the marriage story. It's definitely warms the heart. But the other side of that is the very real danger and harm that comes with having your livelihood and your personhood threatened.
If these issues aren't addressed by lawmakers, they are beginning to be addressed by the courts. For example, the Ninth Circuit, based in San Francisco, recently introduced a higher level of scrutiny for equal protection cases involving LGBT people. University of Wyoming law professor Stephen Feldman says courts almost always use the lowest level of scrutiny, called rational review, in those instances.
Traditionally, rational basis review under equal protection is a rubber stamp.
Meaning those cases almost always go the government's way. What the Ninth Circuit did was apply intermediate or heightened scrutiny.
Heightened scrutiny is a very ambiguous term. It means anything above rational basis review.
What's important is that heightened scrutiny flips the burden of proof from the group of people challenging a given law to the government defending it. That makes defending policies that discriminate against LGBT people in employment or housing way, way harder. For now, this heightened scrutiny is only applied in the Ninth Circuit. The Supreme Court has declined to review the decision. It may if a different federal court comes to a different conclusion. At the Albany County Courthouse, these issues couldn't be farther from anyone's mind. But it's possible even those who are worrying about employment discrimination might not have to worry much longer, at least in Wyoming. Representative Connolly says now that same-sex marriage is law, she's very optimistic she'll be able to get her anti-discrimination bill passed when the legislature meets in January.
In the end, that legislation did not pass at the state level. But for people fired because they are gay, help can come from state and federal officials reinterpreting old laws. Josh Reisner is from Casper. He was fired from his longtime job at a food services company after a new manager found photos of a male gymnast on Reisner's phone. A female coworker told Reisner the manager told her,
"You know, he has this picture of a guy on his phone, and if you, as a woman, had this picture on your phone, it would have been okay, but Josh is a guy. That's just, we can't have that."
Cherie Doak is the deputy administrator with Wyoming's Labor Standards Department, and she says this is a clear case of gender stereotyping, which is illegal. Gender stereotyping has been used in cases before, mostly involving women. The argument is that firing or denying a job to someone because they don't act manly or feminine enough is a form of sex discrimination outlawed by the 1964 Civil Rights Act. According to Doak, the manager
is objecting to the individual's nonconformance with gender stereotypes in that men should only like women or only have pictures of women on their phone, and only women can have pictures of men on their phone.
For Reisner, that would mean he was wrongly fired based on discrimination. It's still a battle for people like Reisner, but one Wyoming town passed employment protection for LGBT people on its own after the measure was defeated at the state level. Here's Miles Bryan again.
20-year-old college student Kylie Ann Erickson was in the room when the city council in Laramie passed its LGBT anti-discrimination bill earlier this year. She says when the final vote was counted, she breathed a sigh of relief.
So I don't have to be like have that in the back of my mind like, oh, this isn't going to be why I'm fired. If I'm fired, it's going to be because I'm doing a bad job.
The ordinance bans discrimination against LGBT people in employment, housing, and public accommodations like bars and restaurants. It had extra meaning because just a few months earlier, the Wyoming state legislature voted down a bill that would have done the same statewide. Erickson is gay, and she says she now feels more secure at her job at a local hardware store.
I was just so excited when they were like, well, this is it. It's official.
Laramie is one of a growing number of cities and counties that have passed their own measures to protect gay and lesbian people. Here in Wyoming and in other Republican-led states like Florida and Idaho, state-level bills meant to protect LGBT people have been repeatedly voted down or stalled out in committee. Paul Weaver is a Laramie City Council representative.
The state didn't pass it. We were hoping the state would. They didn't, so we felt like there was a need for us to do it.
Weaver says the fact that Laramie is a college town, a blue dot in a red state, helped get the city ordinance passed after the state bill went down. Dozens of local businesses signed a petition in favor of the ordinance, and each time it was debated, Weaver says City Hall was packed.
There were some personal accounts related that dealt with some of the difficulties that people had about not having this protection afforded to them. And it was powerful to hear those. It helps you make that personal connection.
Because we know that people grow to support LGBT equality when they know LGBT people.
Jeremy Pittman is with the Human Rights Campaign, a national LGBT advocacy group. He says his group has been focusing on getting local-level ordinances passed in places like Laramie, where statewide efforts have failed. Right now, the human rights campaign's largest local fronts are Jacksonville, Florida, Charlotte, North Carolina, and Houston, Texas. But Pittman says even if those cities pass protections, it won't be enough.
The patchwork of protections that exist today provides a strong level of protection in some cities and in some states, but that's simply not good enough. It shouldn't matter where you live as to whether you're going to be protected against discrimination.
For Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Miles Bryan.
The Shepherd Symposium on Social Justice takes place every year at the University of Wyoming. In 2015, the symposium featured the Self-Evident Truths Project. I.O. Tillett Wright is the founder of and photographer for the project, as well as an LGBT activist. She attempted to photograph 10,000 people in all 50 states who identify as anything other than 100% straight, in hopes of showing Americans the diverse makeup of the LGBT community. When Tillett Wright spoke with Wyoming Public Radio's Caroline Ballard, she said the idea for Self-Evident Truths came from her own childhood.
My parents were both very open to me expressing what my identity was. So when I was 6, I decided that I wanted to be a boy, and I lived that full time until I was 14. And they never forced me into any boxes about it. And that kind of produced this interesting mindset that I have now that's also very different to most LGBT people, where they have been disowned by their families or were given a lot of grief by their families. I am kind of like an ambassador of what it can be like when your parents actually completely accept you for what you are.
So it's the Self-Evident Truths Project. Can you explain a little bit about it?
The name comes from the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. I'm photographing 10,000 people who identify as anywhere on the LGBT spectrum in all 50 states and taking those 10,000 portraits to the Washington Monument. And I'm going to lay them out on the National Mall and stage some kind of event around it. And the idea is just to present a vast cross-section of this community across the entirety of the nation and present the idea that we are not some baby-eating Gila monster freakazoids. We are the people who drive your bus, who cook your food, who take care of your children, who protect your streets, who heal you when you go to the hospital. You know, we are everywhere and we are everyone already. And it's just a matter of whether you're going to deny that or acknowledge it.
Your goal originally was 2 weeks, and then it was 4,000 people, and now it's 10,000 people, and you're getting pretty close to that number. So what about this spurred such growth, and will you actually stop at 10,000, or are you going to keep going?
Oh my God, no, I'm going to stop at 10,000. No, the original 2 weeks was just a tester. We were just like, will people even show up? And they did. They came out and drove. And then it was more a matter of, okay, how do we fund this now? And we made that video that's like a 2-minute black and white little fun video that announces my intentions. And then 85,000 people watched that and started emailing us and being like, come to places like Laramie, Wyoming, come to North Carolina, come to Nebraska, please, we need you. And then it became like not a matter of choice. I just had to do it. So I did a Kickstarter. And the Kickstarter, I presented it as, look, our minimum goal is $12,000 so that we can do San Francisco and LA. And if we raise more than that, I'll keep going. And we raised 14. So it's just been like inch by inch by inch by inch. And then I realized after I photographed 350 people in New York, 300 people in San Francisco, and 250 people in LA, I was like, wait a second. Now I have 950 people and I haven't even left the coastal utopias. So Eve Ensler, who wrote the Vagina Monologues, came on as a very early benefactor of the project and was like, I don't think you should get corporate sponsorship. How do you want to pay for this? I will give you $10,000. What will you do with that $10,000? And my immediate response was, I want to go to the Deep South, which is kind of like a little skinny nerd walking into a basketball game and asking for a beating. But I did it because I felt like those were the areas where nobody ever shines a flashlight. Nobody ever goes to Laramie, Wyoming and is like, hey, gays, come out. Hey, trans people, come out and let me photograph you and give you some attention. So it became readily apparent that within 4,000 people, I couldn't get the cross-section, the diversity that I wanted to have for this thing to be impactful. So I decided to make it 10,000 and all 50 states.
You mentioned it's a little bit like a skinny nerd walking into a basketball game and asking for a beating. Are you ever worried that someone who's hostile might show up, that you might get negative reactions?
Yeah, absolutely. When we were going through the Deep South, I really thought every day I woke up and was like, today might be the day that the Westboro Baptist Church shows up and harasses you and harasses the children and older people who come to your shoot. And like, what are you going to do about that? You know, I'm from New York, so my initial response is always like, oh, fight them. But then it's like, as an ambassador, first of all, I'm 118 pounds and I'm 5'9" and a half. So I'm like a toothpick. Second of all, as an ambassador of a community or whatever I've become, as like a mouthpiece for a group of people, there are nonviolent ways that you have to approach something like that. So I've had my rhetoric prepared for 5 years, and it's never happened.
Never.
No.
Ayo, you mentioned Eve Ensler as one of the people who was an early supporter and how she told you that you shouldn't do this with corporate money. So how are you funding it?
We sell T-shirts. They're just like cute black T-shirts that say "We Are You" down the front in white. They're unisex. For every T-shirt that's sold for $20, one of the faces, the 10,000 faces on the National Mall, gets sponsored. So let's say I buy a shirt on the National Mall, a random photo will say sponsored by Ayo Tillit Wright, 29 Los Angeles. And that's really the only way that we fund the project, and with private donations. Also, because when you wear that shirt, a kid who's not out may see it and they will know that they are okay by you and they're a little bit safer in the world because they've seen your shirt or they've seen the sticker and they know that somebody out there supports them.
Ayo Tillit Wright is a photographer and activist. She's the founder of the Self-Evident Truths Project. Ayo, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Schools across the country have embraced sweeping anti-bullying measures in recent years. Universities and school districts are encouraging teachers to celebrate diversity and discourage exclusionary language. But at the 2013 Shepherd Symposium on Social Justice, the University of Wyoming hosted a group that said teachers need to be explicit about their acceptance of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer or questioning students. Wyoming Public Radio's Rebecca Martinez tracked down some Laramie educators to ask them about that idea.
It is my personal belief that anyone getting into education, if you're not there to educate every kid that comes into your room, what in the world are you doing in that job?
In a bustling Laramie coffee shop, Laramie High School social studies teacher Will Plum is chatting with his colleague, Nicole Bondurant, and one of their former students, Nicholas Jesse. The three know each other from LHS's Gay Straight Alliance, a club that functions as a support group for LGBT students and their allies. Nick Jesse was a member, and Bondurant and Plum are co-sponsors. Plum is straight, but he remembers that his peers gave him grief as a kid because he took dance lessons, and his teachers were no help either.
I had teachers say, what are you, some sort of fag, Plum? And I hated education. I hated it. If you had told me at 18 I was going to be a teacher, I would have told you where to go and how to get there, because I could not think of a more vile environment.
Subsequent experience changed his mind, obviously, but not his disdain for slurs of any kind. Plum and Bondurant are quick to admonish and correct students who use derogatory phrases to describe rural people, Mormon people, gay people. LHS graduate Nick Jesse came out as gay when he was a sophomore. Now he's double majoring at UW. Jesse had a positive experience in high school, and he says these teachers had a lot to do with that.
It made me feel like kind of empowered, actually, when they would bring up the fact that, you know, they were against these words and like why you can't use them. And it made me feel like I could be myself just a little bit more.
These are the kinds of results the Shepherd Symposium for Social Justice is hoping for in Wyoming schools. The symposium has invited a group called GLARE, which stands for LGBTQ Advocacy in Research and Education, to encourage future teachers and counselors to integrate awareness of LGBTQ issues in schools. GLARE is based in the School of Education at Brooklyn College in New York.
There's no school that is going to talk about, you know, having second-class citizens, but when we treat
certain groups of people as subnormal. You know, it can easily be deducted from the way that people interact with each other.
That's Maria Sharon Del Rio, a professor in the school counseling program at Brooklyn College and one of the leaders of GLARE. She cites national data from the Gay, Lesbian, and Straight Education Network, or GLSEN, that show more than half of LGBT students often feel unsafe at school because of their sexual orientation, and a third skipped school because they felt unsafe. GLSEN also found that schools with active gay-straight alliances had overall reductions in bullying. Sharon Del Rio encourages teachers to understand and be explicitly supportive of LGBT people, and she wants educators to teach about that population's contribution to society and how sexual orientation is just one type of diversity.
What makes us more effective as future teachers, future professors, future leaders, is to be really comfortable in navigating these intersections, both within the groups that we're part of and the groups that we don't know.
The Wyoming Department of Education administers a questionnaire every other year surveying students about bullying issues. The data shows that bullying in Wyoming high schools jumped 25% from 2009 to 2011 and by 50% in middle schools during that time, but they never specifically asked about LGBTQ issues. Wyoming school safety consultant Bruce Hayes says they will include a question about sexual orientation in their bullying questionnaire this year. As a former educator, Hayes says teachers need to be supportive and protective of all their students, but he's not sure that explicitly focusing on LGBT issues in the classroom will make much of a difference.
I think the jury's still out. Some people feel that it's very important to focus on that group. Other people feel that, you know, we don't need to do that, or that we need to keep an umbrella tolerance of everybody. I think the jury's still out if that's going to be effective or not.
Kim Sorensen, principal of Laramie High School, disagrees. He says, as principal, it's proven very important to be very clear that bullying includes harassing LGBT students. He says openly tolerant teachers, the presence of a thriving gay-straight alliance, and a school policy that explicitly prohibits bullying based on real or perceived sexual orientation has promoted an overall atmosphere of tolerance at his school.
You know, when we go all the way back to Matthew Shepard, there was bullying and harassing going on here before then. There's bullying and harassing continuing on today. But we have a lot more people aware of the ramifications of that. We have a lot more people aware of how to successfully intervene. We have a lot more people that know what to do if they're a victim.
Sorensen says he'd like to see more teachers trained to be supportive of LGBT issues and more teachers setting an example of respect and tolerance for their students. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Martinez.
So as we've heard, some teachers, lawmakers, and artists are trying to create a more inclusive future for LGBT people in Wyoming. Now the state will serve as a place where LGBT history in the West can be chronicled as well. The University of Wyoming's American Heritage Center has an archive called Out West in the Rockies, which spotlights LGBT history in the American West. Caroline Ballard sat down with Gregory Hinton, who spent his childhood in Wyoming and Montana, and co-created the archive.
And I came out in 1975 in Boulder. And Boulder, you would have thought, would have been the most easygoing, accepting place in the world. But I told my parents immediately. I also called my brother and he said, we'll join the club. We were close, but we had never discussed it. I had no idea that he was gay also. And my mom called a family meeting. Their main concern for us, my mom and my dad, was that we wouldn't be lonely all of our lives and that that no harm would come to us. And they also said, as far as having two gay sons, it was better two than one. So we would always have each other. And what happened subsequently, within weeks of that meeting, a call comes to our house from a theology student in Boulder threatening to drive me from Boulder with whips and chains. First, he spoke to my mother. She screams. My dad picks up the phone and he listens and he said, if you ever call this house again, I'll kill you. And I'm sitting there hearing this and horrified with the shame of it all and with the fact that suddenly their worst fears were realized. But I also heard that we would be supported no matter what. And that's just the turning point of my emotional life, that particular event. I trace so much back to that moment of of knowing that it would have its difficult times.
Out West is sort of your baby. It's a national program highlighting the LGBT community's influence in the West. Where exactly did you get the idea?
I was fortunate to be invited to UCross Foundation up in Clermont, Wyoming, which is a very, very nationally recognized arts residency program. And so I came to write, you know, finish a novel I was writing about my dad called Night Rodeo. And so I get there, and UCross is a 20,000-acre working ranch. And the residency manager took our group of artists that had arrived at the same time I did, six of us, on an orientation tour of the ranch. And all of a sudden, she starts pointing out, well, that was the house where Annie Proulx staged a scene in her short story, Brokeback Mountain. And the thought kind of hit me like, you know, Wyoming is so known for Brokeback Mountain, and it moves so many people tremendously. And so many people opine about what the LGBT experience is in the West, largely informed by the tragedy of the murder of Matt Shepard and Brokeback Mountain. They have opinions about Wyoming without actually having come here. And I thought how great it would be if, with all the scholarship that I've aggregated over the last several years, I thought, well, there should really be a repository for it, a place where the papers and the research could all be in one place, so that people who want to know about LGBT rural Western experience could come to better study it and better understand it. And I was missing Wyoming even as I was up in UCross, and I thought, how many other LGBT folks from rural Western backgrounds miss the communities and families where they came from, because so many of us evacuated, at least in my generation, and I use that word. It was a true evacuation out of this world into the protection of the urban cities.
You say evacuated. What has changed between when you left Wyoming and now that's made a project like Out West in the Rockies, the archive at the American Heritage Center, possible?
I tell you, it's the desire not just of me, but other folks that I've met kind of on my travels through the Rocky Mountain states, that we want to claim our heritage. We're stakeholders in our own history and in the places we come from. And I like to say, well, even if they don't want us, we still want them. And so I think what's changing is more and more people are staying, more and more people are visible, and some, like me, are coming back. If not necessarily to move here, but at least to enjoy your arts parks and your history. It's so beautiful here, and how can we continue to relinquish that? So I think that's changing in a great way, and I hope that Out West, you know, informs that a bit.
That was Gregory Hinton talking with Wyoming Public Radio's Caroline Ballard. And that's it for this edition of The Modern West. You can catch our next episode on the third Tuesday of the month. If you like what you hear, we would very much appreciate a positive rating wherever you're listening. In the meantime, you can find more stories about the Modern West at our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. Connor McCracken-Flesher produced this episode. Anna Rader is our web editor. The theme music is by Jeff Troxell, and I'm Micah Schweitzer. The Modern West is a production of Wyoming Public Media.